Okay, we're on page 5. And we're now to the place where we're going to begin to demonstrate most properly that every psychological system that is claimed is a theological system, that there is a theological commitment that is taking place every time somebody is doing counseling, whether they're aware of that or not. There's a quotation here from Heath Lambert. Engaging in counseling practice is a theological engagement. Evaluating, debating with various counseling practitioners, whether secular, Christian, or biblical, is a theological enterprise. You are simply not ready to think about counseling, let alone practice it, until you have thought long and hard about theology. David Pallison. Counseling practices methods designed to facilitate change in beliefs, behaviors, feelings, attitudes, values, and the like. These ideas and practices inhabit an institutional and professional system where a practitioner first receives training and then delivers the goods. An undergraduate department in graduate school, a psychiatric hospital, a clinic, a private practice, a support group, a self-help book, a church. A psychology, and there are many of them, creatures of time and place, of the aspirations of their creators, of the worldview of their socio-cultural surround, is not an impersonal abstraction. Psychologies are believed and taught by persons. Psychotherapies are done by persons. A psychology proposes a system of truth and ministry, and it must be evaluated as such. Psychologies are most like practical theologies. Okay, so here's an illustration. I want you to imagine there is a woman. The woman is unhappy in her marriage. She's very depressed. And she comes to speak to you. Now, a great illustration of this might be there's all of the various cultures that are here in South America that I'm ignorant of. If a woman were to come to speak to someone in one of these various cultures that I'm unfamiliar with, I obviously come from a traditional Western European kind of culture, but somebody came from a different kind of traditional culture, and the woman was approached, there'd be very different kinds of things that might be said or done with that woman than would be done with me, correct? All right? And what if the same woman were living in Pakistan, and she were a Muslim, and she went and spoke with someone there? They would say something that would be very different than what the woman would hear in South Africa or what she might hear in Europe or the United States. And what if the woman went to see a psychiatrist instead of a psychologist? The way the psychiatrist would respond to this woman would be different than what a psychologist would respond to her. And if she went to see a Freudian psychologist, there would be one kind of response. And if it was somebody who followed Adler, it'd be a slightly different response. If somebody went to see somebody who was a Rogerian psychologist, it would be different again, a Jungian psychologist, quite different than the Rogerian. If they went to see a behavioralist, they would receive something. Or somebody who does marriage and family counseling, and they would talk about family systems and dynamics. Somebody who was interested in Maslow and humanistic psychology would approach it as a different way again. Now, all of these people would respond to this woman in a very, very different sort of way. But all of them would be doing psychology, if you will. Well, why is it that all of these people would do something so different with this woman? And this is, as you'll see here as we go through this, it's going to be because they have a different anthropology, that is, what is a human being? And it's here in the notes. We're going to get to it. I'm telling you what we're going to get to, just so you know, like at the beginning of a sermon where you go, okay, here's my 3 points, and then it takes the next hour to get them. Okay, so there's going to be ATM. There's going to be an anthropology. There's going to be a teleology. That's just the Greek word telos. It means what are you aiming at? What's the goal? And a methodology. How are you going to go about doing this? All right? So let's start to go through the notes here. We're on page 6. So what is psychology? We've been talking about this a bit. So somebody here we've talked about it a lot so far, but just to see if I'm making sense, if we're tracking it all, would somebody like to take a stab at just repeating back in a sentence or two, what is a psychology? What is a psychology? You're not going to get graded. Nobody's going to get a bad score. I just need you to be brave enough to talk in front of 50 people you don't know real well. Yes? That is fine. An analysis of human behavior. Why do people do what they do? That's about it. That's really all we mean by psychology. You know, it's interesting. As Sabrin told you, I teach Introduction to Psychology at the university. It's one of the classes that all of the biblical counseling students need to take, because we want them to have some familiarity with these things. And a great deal of what is in the psychology book, and when we're trying to make psychology scientific, is taking something that everybody knows and putting a fancy label on it. Like, there's stuff that bugs you, right? That's a stressor. Sounds a lot more fancy when you call it a stressor, right? There are things that bother you all the time. There are things that bother you just for a little bit of time, like they're, you know, like this moment, but it's not every day, all day. Different names for those kinds of stressors. There are stressors that bother you, but don't bother everybody. Or are things that bother everybody. Names for both of those things. There are things like, you know, when you look at something and you're kind of looking around the room right here and you're paying attention to it and you realize that there's a, by the way, the exit signs kind of crack me up because everybody's running in South Africa apparently when you're leaving buildings. Because that in the United States would be like, that would mean like something's on fire if you were running. That would like be like, so I always look at that and I think danger the first thing. But, you know, you notice that there's an exit sign and you don't think about it again. Well, that's a kind of memory. Or, you know, you're paying attention to things. That's another kind of memory. Or there's a kind of memory that you know stuff, but you haven't thought about it for a long time. That has its own name. So a lot of the stuff is they just take common sense things that everybody knows and they put a title on it and you give them a test and it proves that they learned psychology. It just proves that they memorized a bunch of terms. They haven't learned anything yet for the most part. So that's really all a psychology is. Psychology is just some kind of way to explain things. And it sounds scientific because you put a bunch of names on it, but that didn't make it scientific. And as a real practical matter, it's very, very problematic even to call psychology a science. I'm not saying that there's not scientific work that is done by people who would be called psychologists. So for instance, when people study neurology and the physiology of how your brain functions, when people are studying how exactly do your senses function, when people have noticed that there's a certain amount of difference that you have to have in order to be able to tell if something's hotter or colder or heavier or lighter, there's certain gradients, there's amount of difference that have to be between those things. Those are things that people study, and that can be, you know, good scientific work. That's real science, like how does a person's brain function? So what does that nerve do? That sort of stuff. But a great deal of what passes for psychology, even though it has fancy names on it, really can't be considered to be a science. It's at best, it's kind of rule of thumb. It's an observation that people make. And they go, yeah, that usually ends up that way. Let me give you an example of what I mean by this. All right. Now, we could do some science here. You saw my hand move. You saw it strike this. You heard a sound come out. It correlated with when my hand struck against this. So we do a little bit of science there. We see cause. We see effect. It's a replical experience. I notice it makes a different sound if my hand hits here than if it hits here. Okay, so there's some of this must be having to do with the kind of wood and how much space there is beneath it and all the rest. Now, that's science. There's a limited number of variables. We can replicate it. We can see the relationships that are going on between the parts. When it comes to human beings, you can't do anything like that. I want you to think, even with that, and we're going to talk about the Godward influences, and that's the most crucial aspect of the human being. But even without getting to the Godward aspect of the human being, a human being is far too complex to know precisely how the parts go together. Because the things that go into effect a human being are going to be all of the experience they have had, all the experiences they do have right now. So you have all of their environment, right? And their environment takes place in a certain sociological framework. So there's, you know, like things mean something because of where you're from. You know, like I gave you the joke about the guy running looks like, you know, somebody in danger to me, and everybody here knows it's just an exit. Why are you running every time you see the sign? You know, it just means to go out this way. So there's a sociological construct in which I take that information in. There's all kinds of things that go on in my body. Your brain is more complicated than all of the electrical gizmos put together in the whole world. It's more fabulously complicated than you can imagine. One of the best studied parts of the brain, they found out, has an entirely new function that they didn't know about. I remember reading about that just a couple of weeks ago. And your brain tissue goes down into your heart and into your colon. And it turns out that your colon, like the rest of your body, is influenced by the kind of bacteria that you have in your colon at any particular time. And that's something that's relatively recently understood too. So there is some understanding that perhaps some of your mood, the way you feel, is affected by the kind of bacteria that's in your gut. And they don't even know what all kinds of bacteria in your gut. So as we're going along, you have all of the systems inside your body. You have all the relationship between all these systems inside your body. You have all of your own personal history. You have all of your own personal influences. They went together in a different order in you than they did in me. And you're going to tell me you can precisely map out why this thing is going on based on tracing through all those influences? You don't even know what all the influences are. Even assuming that you could do that, and even assuming that would give you the right answer, it's an impossibly complex task. So to begin to call that a science is ridiculous. Now, there's kinds of things that happen. And we can understand how that works when we start to use a scriptural understanding of it. So, for instance, when you start to look at the history of a person, when we're sinned against, we have a tendency to sin in response to that. In fact, we very often have a tendency to sin in the same way that we've been sinned against. You know, if I were to come up to one of you and I were to be angry at you and yell at you, it might not be surprising if you became angry and yelled back. Sin's catchy. Sin has a tendency to beget sin, and it tends to look in the same kind of way. People who have been sinned against in a particular way have a tendency to sin in the same sort of way. Now, it's not cause and effect, and nobody's locked into that. I don't mean that at all. And I certainly don't mean that people can't change. If I didn't believe that, I wouldn't be here. So we can start to see there's relationships between these things, but to be able to tie them down into some sort of a sin, well, that's just not possible. The same two people may respond very, very differently to the same sort of thing in their environment. Something may agitate you greatly that doesn't bother me in the least. I remember when I was in college, I went with friends of mine in my college. I wanted to see what Las Vegas looked like. I hate the city. I never want to go back again. If you don't know what it is, it's this place that's just very debauched, and you go there primarily to gamble. And I have never been so bored in my entire life. I just couldn't wait till we went home. I wanted to see what the place looked like. They all drove there. I drove in the car. And I spent most of my time walking around. But the friend of mine, who's actually an anthropology professor, and so I just had him do, like, what would an anthropologist see here? And so that was actually kind of fun. But the rest of it just bored me to no end. But I had other friends who, like, it was the biggest snare that ever existed to be in this city. It was a pit that they couldn't crawl out of. Same people were the same age. We had roughly the same kind of backgrounds. We had the same amount of money. We came from the same place. We went together, and we had wildly different responses to the same sort of thing. So you can't really nail it down that tightly. There are observations that people make that are true, and they tend to be true pretty much. You know, how you dress when you go to a job interview. You know, how should you respond in a job interview? Those are things that somebody could make as a psychological, if you will, observation. And those can be kind of useful, but I wouldn't say they're a science. They're certainly not a science the way physics is a science or mathematics is a science. So I'm not saying that people don't make valid observations or they don't see interesting things when they're doing this, but we can't start calling this science. So this isn't the Bible versus science. So let's not go there. And before I go on, does anybody have a problem with that proposition? Does anybody think, no, you're crazy, psychology is the hardest of all sciences, and anybody who gets that wrong deserves not to be in front of the room and teaching me? Is that a difficulty with anyone here? Okay, and by the way, if you do disagree with me, that's perfectly fine. I'm not going to be mad at you. I'm not going to belittle you. I'll try to understand you as well as I can. and I'm happy to dialogue with you. And if we can't finish it up here, I'll be happy to talk to you afterwards. So I'm not here to try to be disrespectful about what anybody thinks about anything. I want you to think about these things and understand them well. All right, let's continue on. All right, page 7, number 2. What are the bare minimums for a counseling psychology? ATM, anthropology, teleology, and methodology. You have to know what you're dealing with. You have to know what you're trying to aim towards. And you have to know, how do you work with this? Okay. So in anthropology, study of human beings, what is a human being? Now, is a human being a bare physical body? Does that exhaust everything we need to know about human beings? All right. But there are a great many very well-educated people who hold to the proposition that a human being is, and to use their language, a wet robot. It's kind of funny, because if you told somebody you were a robot, they'd lock you up for being insane. But you're also considered to be very highly educated if you think human beings are robots, which is a perplexing sort of problem. There's also another really strange sort of problem if human beings are robots. The reason why this makes a noise when it does it is because that's what these physical things do when they're in proximity of one another and you put them together like that. They just have to do. Like the board doesn't say, I wonder if I want to reproduce a sound. I could vibrate at a particular frequency. That would send waves going through the air, which would produce... I could do that. You know, the board doesn't do that. The board just acts, because the board has no choice, right? Okay. And if I were to throw these papers here, they would go through the air in a particular way, because that's what those papers do, and the influence of this much air pressure with this much energy behind them, there's no way around it, is there? Of course, that would be what happened. All right. If human beings are robots, then the things that we do, we have to do them because we're robots, because that's all robots do. Before we left tonight, my boys were watching Robot Wars, where it's like these guys would make robots and they would attack each other and try to tear the other robots up. Apparently, that's what you do with technology. And the robots did what the robots did because there were guys with controllers running them into each other, because robots don't have a choice. That's what robots do. If human beings are bare machines, then human beings are robots. Now, the robots don't know the robots, do they? Because robots only do what they have to do. They don't make any choice about it. They can't actually think. The robots just have to do things, which would mean that if human beings were robots, we wouldn't know it. And we would have no reason to know that it's true, because we'd only be thinking those things because we have to think those things, because that's what we were programmed to think. The robot doesn't stop and think, is this true? The robot just does something, right? Yeah. If human beings are robots, then we wouldn't know that we were robots. Because if we think we're robots, we only think we're robots because we have to think that we're robots. I mean, it becomes silly really quick, doesn't it? Charles Darwin made the same kind of observation, by the way, in a letter that he wrote to a friend. He said, if my theory is true, then I have a monkey brain, and why should anyone trust that? So we can scratch that off the list. By the way, that's super educated. Really smart guys all believe that. And speaking with a professor at Caltech, I don't know if you know Caltech, but it's one of the most prestigious universities in the United States. Very well known for doing science. And I was talking with a professor there. We're acquaintances. I wouldn't say that we're friends, but we've spoken on more than one occasion at length. And he made mention, he said, my colleagues, by the way, are very superstitious. But the most superstitious people are the people with the highest amount of science education. There's this weird sort of thing that happens. The more materialistic they get, the more physical they get, the more superstitious they become. And at some point, perhaps we could talk about that, but it'd be a little bit off track why it ends up there. But there's this odd sort of thing that really well-educated people are superstitious. It's just kind of funny. Okay. Does a human being have an immaterial spirit? Do human actions have moral consequence? Are those moral consequences relevant to a deity? Are those moral consequences simply practical are sociological. When somebody does something, does that have moral consequence? Does your decision to do or not do a thing have moral significance? You know, I'll give an example, and I'll take an extreme example. You can see how hard it is. When people try to anchor the intuition that human beings have that murder is wrong, it is wrong to murder people. Anybody have a problem with that idea? Everybody's good. Well, everybody knows murder is wrong. Okay, why? Without arguing from God says, how do you get to murder is wrong? You really can't. You can't come up with a real cogent explanation. Well, what happens if everybody murdered? I don't care. As long as I don't get murdered, what do I care? And I'm not, you know, like everybody doesn't murder because they're a bunch of cowards. I'm willing to do it, so why should I get in trouble? What's wrong with it? That person deserved to die. I don't like them. Why should they be on the planet with me? Why shouldn't my opinion about who's alive and who's dead be most important? Well, because it's wrong. Well, why is it? What does wrong mean? Because I don't like it. You know, I mean, can you get past it's icky? A lot of times you can't. You see, if you can't anchor human morality and relevance to a deity, it doesn't mean anything. It's just because you like it or not. You see that coming, you know, with abortion and euthanasia. It's enormous numbers. In the city of New York, over half of the pregnancies are terminated by abortion. In the United States, something like over 80% of all black babies are aborted. Planned Parenthood did a marvelous job. It did more than any sort of racist organization ever did in destroying a huge part of my country. It's very, very sad. See, if human beings don't count, then who cares what you do to them? What does it matter? So you see, you're making those kinds of determinations about what a human being is. If you want to use a Freudian methodology to try to speak to a human being and to talk about what a human being is, you're importing Freud's understanding of how a human being functions. If you want to use Abraham Maslow's humanistic psychology, then you're importing Abraham Maslow's anthropology of a human being. You can't avoid it. These were very, very brilliant, talented men who were very deliberate in how they were making their decisions and what they did. And those decisions have very real consequences on how human beings live. Sartre, the French existentialist philosopher, gave a lecture about human beings should be ultimately completely self-determining in everything that they are. I get to say who I am about every aspect of my life. I'm not certain the extent to which you have it here, but in the United States, a boy can walk into his principal in junior high school and say he's a girl, and everyone has to call him that, or, you know, under pain of being, you know, dismissed or sued. Well, your physical body, I mean, you see this becomes bizarre. Your physical body isn't really who you are anymore. I mean, what is more who you are than your physical body? But it's not real anymore. It's whatever you happen to call it. That's a consequence of what Sartre thought a human being to be. And if human beings are merely sociological functions, then why not? You see, these decisions that we make about what a human being is have profound consequences on how we're going to handle human beings. Continuing on here. The psychology, down to number C, the psychology chosen will be dependent upon a more comprehensive philosophy or theology. Many systems are reluctant to call their system a theology, and we'll discuss that a little bit below. A true anthropology is not immediately universally, you know, somebody's true anthropology is not immediately and universally apparent nor agreed. See, one of the things that's happened here is what a human being is, that I've been illustrating this, is not something that everybody agrees to. People have all sorts of understandings of what a human being is. In the United States right now, one's sexual behavior is determined by their genes, but one's sex is not determined by their body. One's race may or may not be determined by their body. That one is up for grabs at the moment. So nobody's quite certain whether it's that. So a boy could be a girl or a girl could be a boy, but I might be a 75-year-old Zulu man. Or not. I'm not certain whether that one's permissible. So that, because that one has some legal consequences for immutable characteristics. But somehow one's sex isn't an immutable characteristic, but one's skin color is, but maybe not. Because again, I said that one is being debated back and forth. I do recall a debate on television where there was a white man debating with a black woman, and the white man was telling the black woman that he's a proud black woman, and she was very angrily telling him he's neither. So, and there was a lot of brouhaha because one of the directors of a local chapter of the NAACP, which is a black civil rights group in the United States, was a white woman who was pretending to be black. And she like skin colored and did all kinds of stuff. It was, and she insists that she really is black. And they're having a really, I saw a man on a college campus and he looks like me. And he was walking up to the students on the college campus saying that I'm a, you know, 7-year-old Asian woman and I'm 6'4". And they said, yeah, one person gave him a little pushback as to whether he was really 6'4". But the rest of them were all perfectly willing to accept him as an Asian woman. I don't know what to say. But that's a kind of theory about what a human being is, isn't it? By the way, I am not a proud black woman. I'd be fine if I were, I guess, but I'm not. So, although, yeah, my wife would probably have a lot to say about that too. All right. Even seemingly simple things like what the sun means have become very difficult for human beings. And being human makes the question difficult for us. And human beings have all these things. We're relational, we're historical, we're moral, we're physical, we're spiritual beings. And we've talked a little bit about some of the ways that human beings have been considered at various times in human culture. I'll give you some more examples. Like in Hindu and Buddhism, a human being is an illusion. And the thing that a human being has to get over is the realization that a human being is a human being. Once you get past that illusion, you will be able to go to nirvana and you'll cease to exist somehow. Or the Enlightenment, you know, the human being is this very rational thing. And if we merely behave rationally, we can understand everything correctly. Or Stoicism or Gnosticism. Or what does the Bible say about what a human being is? The meaning of human beings is based upon other considerations. So, for instance, what do human beings mean if the universe is self-existence and human beings are cosmic accidents? I want you to believe for a moment that Carl Sagan was right. I don't know if you know, he's a guy who's famous in the United States for saying, you know, the universe is all there is and all there ever will be. All right? So that's all there is. Once upon a time, somehow there were the laws of physics. I don't know how the laws of physics got here before there was any place, but they did. Which is one of the huge problems with the universe causes itself, because it needs to have laws on how it's supposed to function before it exists. Which means that the rules have to exist before you have the game. I'm just repeating. I don't understand it. And so if the whole universe bursts into existence, then what we know for certain is this, that if you leave hydrogen gas alone for long enough, it falls in love and tells stories and cars war and plays football and all kinds of stuff. Because that's all you are, is a bunch of hydrogen gas that's left alone for a long time. You're just a spectacular accident. If human beings are a spectacular accident, then what do they mean? What do human beings mean if they're an accident? What are you? You know, this was profoundly stated in the United States during the Civil Rights Movement in the United States. And one of the signs that were carried by the black men when they were protesting was a sign that simply said, "I am a man." That meant something. There's a humanity there that was being claimed by those men. that was a profoundly theological proposition that was requiring the majority of the United States that tended to call itself Christian to live up to the Christianity that it claimed. There's something to being a man. But if there is no Christian understanding of being a man, then who cares what those other people who look different from me were doing? It doesn't mean anything. It just annoys me if I don't like it. You don't have an answer for that. The guy, so I'm a man, so what's that? You're an accident. I don't care. You look different than me. I'm a tribalist. I win. You know, I mean, do you see where this goes? It goes to terrible places. Do you see there's a theology in abortion? Abortion's telling all these people that human beings aren't human beings. How do we stop them? You know, when human beings are small enough or when they get sick enough and they bother me enough is essentially what it comes down to, you have a right to kill them. If you're the only person who has to interact with them and they bother you enough, then why shouldn't you be able to kill them? That's what happens when you can't anchor this in who God is and what he's done. And if you want to press this thing out a little bit further, just so you know, see, if the universe is all there is, then we're Gnostics. And then there's not any difference between good and evil, is there? There's no difference between killing a man and saving his life, because it just doesn't matter. Six of one, it's half a dozen of the other. That's where this goes. That's the reason why boys can be girls and girls can be boys, because everything is the other thing, because there isn't any distinction. There's no separateness. There's no creature and creator, so there's no difference between anything else. This becomes profoundly important. Continuing on. What if human beings are the result of Vishnu dreaming? That's what a Hindu would believe. What if human beings are created by the tripersonal God? You have a very different thing there, don't you? Okay? What a human being means depends upon what a human being is before God. So now that I've illustrated the point by taking a look at it, I'm just going to state flat out. And so you have here, See the Elemental Religion by James Denny. It's in the index. We're not going to go over it. Here at the very beginning of Calvin's Institutes, Calvin says this. No human being knows what he is until he knows who he is in relationship to God. Human beings are not self-defining entities. Sartre and Maslow were wrong. Human beings are not part of one great creative consciousness. Hume was wrong. Human beings are not merely the result of psychosexual desires being clamped down on by sociological responses. Freud is wrong. Human beings are not beings which are capable of making themselves happy. Dale Carnegie, who caused most of the stuff that, even if you don't know who he is, it's Dale Carnegie's world. You just live in it. How many people here who know Dale Carnegie is? You have no idea how much Dale Carnegie has affected your life. Profoundly. The whole way that the kind of run-of-the-mill psychological thinking about all of the people in the West, at least, and a whole bunch of other places, have been run through Dale Carnegie's self-help courses. All of that self-help, codependency, how to make people feel better, that all came out of his sort of schlock psychology, and he forced it upon the world. It's amazing how much effect he had. And you have no idea who he is. At least a lot of you don't. And I'm not saying that as a slam against you. I just want you to see it's a bunch of junk ideas that got poured into one book, made him very rich. Everybody read it at the time in the mid-century, and the United States and Europe, and he affected everybody. Now, what a human being is what a human being is in relationship to God. We don't define ourselves. We are defined by our relationship to God. When those men carried that sign that said, I am a man, that means something. The reason why it's wrong to kill human beings is because human beings are created in the image of God. That's a responsibility and a duty. It's a role. It's something they have to do. Human beings have a responsibility towards God and towards God's creation. That's why sanctification and obedience and knowing God are important. You know, obedience doesn't save us, but obedience is part of our job description. Ed Welch, I heard him speaking one time. He said, obedience is living in the world as if you believe God told the truth. So this means something. If we don't know who we are in relationship to God, then we don't know who we are. And when you are down with somebody and you're doing counseling, the person that you're speaking with is a human being who has a responsibility to God and stands in a certain responsibility towards other human beings because of their responsibility towards God. They have a responsibility to love God with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love their neighbor as themselves. That's what a human being is and is meant to do. Now, if you're counseling somebody and you don't know that, then you don't know what you're going to do with it. You know, if you go give a kid, Sabrin has a 2-year-old son. If I were to give him my cell phone, he might think it is for throwing at something. Okay? And he might think that the huge crash that it makes is what it was designed for. Because he's a little kid. He doesn't know that it's supposed to be for communicating with other people. You can't tell that from looking at it. It's just blank. Yeah, but it makes sense when you throw it. Yeah, it came on, actually. I'm going to give you an illustration here. So let me give you an illustration. We're going to flesh this out, but I want to give it to you here. There's a clock up in the back of the room. Everybody see the clock back there? Turn around and take a look at the clock. Okay. Now, I want you to imagine that we all drive up to the Congo together, and we meet some people who live in the middle of the jungle, some of the people that my anthropology professor at UCLA lived with. And they've never seen a clock. They have no idea what a clock is. They've lived in a jungle. They know everything about staying alive in a jungle. I'm not saying they're uneducated. They're profoundly educated. If I lived where they did, I'd be dead like inside an hour. Okay, something would bite me, eat me. Something would happen to me really bad. So this is not a matter of education. It's a matter of different education, right? Okay. So I would bring this man in here. And first off, he'd have a problem because he's never lived in a place where there's more than like 10 feet of line of sight. My professor talked to me about the fact that they would take some of the pygmies and they would bring them out to the savannah and they'd see the water buffalo out in the distance. And they wanted to know, where did you get the little animals from? Because they had no sense of perspective because they'd only seen things up close. They'd never seen something so far away that it looked small. So we bring one of those men in here and I show him the clock and I go, what is it? He'd have no idea what to do with this. He wouldn't begin to understand it. Now, after he studies it for a while, he might notice that things go around in circles. So he could tell some kind of a story. He makes a good observation. He sees the thing goes around in circles. And so he starts to tell a story about why it's important for things to go around in circles that would make sense on the world that he lived in. Let's say we got somebody else from England from about 1,000 years ago. This person knows about clocks. They understand. They see that's a clock. But they've only known mechanical clocks. Clocks that are run by weights and gears. And he'd look at that and he realizes it's a clock. And he'd think about it. But he knows nothing about electric motors. He's never even heard about something like that. It wouldn't make sense to him. What's an electric motor? And so he would spend all of his time trying to figure out how you got weights rigged up in the back of that clock. Maybe it's on the other side of the wall or something else. And he would tell some very elaborate story that would make sense of why the clock was turning. But he could never get the right answer because he doesn't know what it is. He would explain it in terms of his own experience and his own understanding. But since he doesn't know electric motors, he'd never explain that it's an electric clock. All right? Are human beings more complicated than electric clocks? By far. How is a human being going to be able to develop a psychology when they know nothing about what's going on inside of the human being? And they've ruled out the most important aspects of the human being as part of the answer. That's not sophisticated, educated psychology. That's willful ignorance. How are you going to help somebody when you refuse to know how human beings work or what they are? You don't know what they are. You don't know what they're built for. How are you going to know how to fix them? Now, I could make the clock do stuff. If I didn't know how to work on an electric clock, like I could rip the face of it off and I could jack the hand around and like forcibly move the hands around the clock. But that doesn't mean I fixed the clock. It means I broke it. How is that different than what they did to that poor girl that we talked about earlier tonight? They broke her. I'm not saying they didn't want to help her. I'm not saying that their desire was not to do her good. In fact, I'm quite certain that all of the people intently wanted to do her good. But they didn't help her. They broke her. You know, you can break something and it'll still do stuff. But it doesn't mean that it works right. It just means that it does whatever you made it do, but that's not what it's for. You could take the phone out and you could hammer nails in with it. But that's not what it's for. You haven't fixed the hammer by using my phone. You've broken my phone. Too much of what passes for psychology is exactly that. Too much of what passes for counseling is just that. I'm not saying that people haven't got somebody to do a little bit of this or a little bit of that, but it doesn't mean you've really done them good. You don't know who you were talking to, and you don't know what you're doing with them. While we're here, and you can take a look at it. Some of this stuff is in the notes, so you can go over it yourself. I want to talk to you last. I want to talk to you quickly about teleology. What's the purpose of a human being? What has a human being been created for? The Westminster Shorter Catechism has a brilliant answer to this. What is the chief end of man in the old-fashioned language? What's the chief purpose that human beings exist for? To glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. Now, if you'd ask most people, they would say, well, what's the chief purpose of a human being? They say to be happy. And you know what? I would agree with them. You're going, wait, just a second. You just said the other thing. No. You see, when you know what a human being is, and you know what a human being is for, and you know where a human being exists, then you realize that being happy, which is where we experience this, right, and glorifying God and enjoying Him forever, aren't separate things. I want you to turn with me over to page 12. On the bottom of page 12, there's a quotation from Jonathan Edwards from his sermons on charity and its fruits. And just so you know, nothing is new. Jonathan Edwards preached a series of sermons on 1 Corinthians 13 because he was deeply concerned that his congregation did not love one another well enough. And the rich people looked down on the poor people, and the poor people were envious of the rich people, and the townspeople didn't like the country people, and vice versa, and they just didn't get along, so he preached on love. I'm going to read you this paragraph here. It is not a thing contrary to Christianity that a man should love himself, or which is the same thing, should love his own happiness. By the way, I want to affirm to you again, this is Jonathan Edwards. This is the archetype of all archetypes when it comes to glorify God. There is no man who was more fixated on that end than Edwards. If Christianity did indeed to destroy a man's love to himself and to his own happiness, it would therein tend to destroy the very spirit of humanity. But the very announcement of the gospel as a system of peace on earth and goodwill towards men shows that it is not only not destructive of humanity, but in the highest degree promotive of the spirit. That a man should love his own happiness is as necessary to his nature as the faculty of his will is, and it is impossible that such a love should be destroyed in any other way than by destroying his being. Of course you love your happiness. The saints love their own happiness. Yes, those that are perfect in happiness, the saints and the angels in heaven, love their own happiness. Otherwise, that happiness which God has given them would be no happiness to them. For that which anyone does not love, he cannot enjoy any happiness in. Let me phrase this a little. I'm going to paraphrase this. And he goes on to describe this at more length. See, the problem human beings have for our end is we want to be happy, right? And I've told you the chief end of man is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. And those are two things that are completely compatible. The problem with human beings is not that we love our own happiness. The problem with human beings is we're bought off too cheap. We are willing to settle for something less than that which will give us the happiness that we crave. You were created for too great a world, too much, too more than this world could possibly give you. You were created for God Himself. Who's happier than God? I want you to imagine for a second God's grumpy. Could you imagine what a horror the universe would be if God were in a bad mood? Who is more perfectly delighted with himself than God? Who has ever been happier than God? It says in Hebrews that for the joy set before him, he endured the cross. You know, the point of Ecclesiastes, or one of the great points of Ecclesiastes, is that nothing in this world will make you as happy as you think it is. All the things in this world are a cheat. They promise you happiness, and they deliver your pain. It's like passion and patience in Pilgrim's Progress. Passion wants to be happy and rips his present open right away, and he looks like he got the better deal. And then just as soon, he's miserable because this world isn't good enough to make you happy. But patience, who waits for what God has, will have nothing come after that. You see, we want people to be happy. The problem is that people think that their sin or this decision or that decision will make them happy. You see, human beings are created so that the only thing which will truly make us happy is God Himself. You were created to delight in God. Anything less than that is a cheat. So, human beings were created to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. And human beings were created to be happy. And those are one and the same thing. The devil, unfortunately, has convinced everybody that those are the opposite. Your job is to convince them that they're not. That's, by the way, do you see how worship then becomes the thing that we're aiming at? When we get there, we can talk more about it. So briefly, all psychologies require two things, an anthropology, a teleology, and a methodology. Those decisions, how what a human being is, what a human being is aimed towards, and how you help a human being change, those things are theological decisions. Those aren't made in the psychology themselves. Those decisions are made before you do the psychology. Psychology is a subset of theology. Everybody who's doing psychology has made those decisions up, whether they've realized it or not. They know who human beings are and what they're trying to do with them. Unfortunately, when you don't start with the scripture, you don't know who your human being is, and you don't know what they're aiming at, so you don't know how to help them. And we could spend some time, we could demonstrate this with methodology, but we're done for this evening. So tomorrow what we'll do is we'll pick up on page 14 because we need to talk a little bit about non-biblical counseling systems and give you some discussion about that, and then we'll get to the attributes of a system.